welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, April 6th. I'm your reader, Kathleen. Here's the front page story. After 20 years, state park camping fees rise. Increases will go toward improvements and promotions. This story by Aaron Jordan for the Gazette. Campers at Iowa state parks this year will pay a few more dollars a night to put up a tent or park their recreational vehicle, with the largest increases coming at state parks with the most visitors and amenities. Authorized by the Iowa legislature in 2018 to set its own fees, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources has raised camping fees for the first time in more than 20 years. Under the four-tier pricing structure, out-of-the-way parks that get fewer visitors won't have a rate increase, but larger parks that draw visitors from across the state and from bordering states will. The nightly increase will be 25% to 55% higher. The more amenities people have, the fee will reflect that, said Todd Kofelt, chief of the Iowa State Parks, Forests, and Preserves Bureau. These fees will come back into our budget. It helps us with our planning and presentation. At Lake McBride State Park near Solon, fees for a full electric water sewer site went from $19 to $26, electric site from $16 to $20, and a primitive site from $9 to $12 a night. Ranger Ron Pootman said campers for years have expressed surprise at how cheap it is to camp at Iowa State Parks. I don't really foresee any hardship at all with the new fees, Pootman said. It's been over 20 years since we increased our fees, and we have no user fee to enter the park. The 2021 fee schedule for all state parks can be found online at iowadnr.gov/places-to-go/state-parks. Iowa State Park System is coming off a blockbuster year when COVID-19 caused many people to look for nearby outdoor vacations. The Iowa DNR brought in nearly $2.3 million in camping fees between July 1 through October 30, 2020, a 33% increase over the same period in 2019. When the pandemic was still present, 2021 likely will be another banner year for camping, fishing, hiking, and water sports. Some state park campgrounds already are open for the season, but the modern restrooms and showers will be opened at all state parks around April 15, Kofelt said. To set the fee increases, the Iowa DNR compared camping prices at other publicly owned facilities within a 60-mile radius of each park. The extra money raised by the increases will go toward renovations of state parks, upkeep, staffing, and promotions of lesser visited parks, Kofelt said. In February, the Iowa DNR offered $100 off the price of a March reservation at a four-bed cabin at Springbrook State Park near Guthrie Center. The four-bedroom cabin has capacity for 14 people. We have a fantastic cabin, but we didn't have any reservations for the month of March, Kofelt said. The promotion helped Iowans know the cabin was available and gave them a deal to book a stay. The next thing we knew, we were able to put five bookings into that facility that did not exist before. Staff at several of Eastern Iowa state parks, heavily damaged in the August 10 derecho, are reopening those parks for the season. McBride's campgrounds reopened last Thursday. All trails are open except for the old entrance trail and Angler's Point Trail, which still have hazard trees and branches. The main lodge will reopen on May 1. Palisades Kepler State Park near Mount Vernon has not allowed visitors since the storm, but will open later this month, Kofelt said. The Iowa DNR also is working to replant trees at Pleasant Creek State Recreation Area near Palo. Also on the front page, UI taps savings to loan $50 million to Hawkeye Athletics. This by Vanessa Miller. Given the tens of millions in losses the University of Iowa Department of Athletics is absorbing from COVID-19's devastating impact, retiring UI President Bruce Harold has agreed to permanently end an earlier deal requiring athletics to contribute $2 million a year in support of academics on the main campus. Additionally, the UI main campus, facing budget cuts amid tens of millions in pandemic-promoted losses of its own, is nonetheless shipping $50 million to the typically self-sustaining athletics department this budget year. That $50 million, according to UI spokeswoman Ann Bassett, will come from the university's cash reserves and be in the form of an internal loan that will be repaid over the next 10 to 15 years. Athletics will continue to be self-sustaining operation, Bassett said. Although COVID-19 ripped through college athletic budgets nationally, beginning in March 2020, Bassett reported UI Athletics managed its fiscal 2020 deficit from athletics accumulated reserve. But Herald and Athletics Director Gary Barta last year temporarily suspended the $2 million athletics contribution agreement in fiscal 2020. Given the significant deficit accumulated by athletics in FY21 due to the cumulative effects of COVID-19, the president agreed to permanently end the annual contribution, Bassett said Monday. Pre-pandemic, Hawkeye Athletics was flush with income, reporting $122.4 million in the 2019 budget year, including $54.9 million from the Big Ten, or NCAA, $7.8 million from its multimedia contract, and $23.6 million in philanthropy or foundation income. That income total represented a near doubling from a decade earlier, when UI Athletics reported $66 million in income, including $19 million from the Big Ten, or NCAA, and $12 million from the foundation. Given shortened seasons and fan restrictions for its biggest moneymakers this academic year, UI Athletics' fiscal 2021 budget, approved in the fall, projected $23 million in total income, including $10 million from the Big Ten or NCAA, about $7.5 million in foundation support, and $1.5 million from its multimedia contract. Those projections were before some semblance of a fall football season materialized, although Barta has said Iowa's athletics deficit still will reach the tens of millions, losses he has cited in justifying his decision to cut four Olympic sports permanently, men's and women's swimming and diving, men's gymnastics, and men's tennis. A federal court recently forced the UI to reverse its elimination of women's swimming and diving, citing a likelihood female athletics would win a Title IX lawsuit accusing the UI of failing to comply with mandates it offer equal athletic opportunities to women. But UI Athletics is standing firm on its move to cut those male sports, despite efforts among supporters and alumni to raise long-term support and establish a new model for sustainability. When UI Athletics in 2017 agreed to start providing $2 million of its annual revenue to the main campus's general education pursuits, Barta reported athletics additionally already provided tens of millions in ancillary support. In the 2016 budget year, for example, UI Athletics reported transferring $23 million to the central campus in form of tuition and room and board from its athletes, medical support, and parking revenue, among other things. In a message from Barta in 2017 about the deal to commit $2 million a year in direct support to the campus's main academic mission, he said, "We're fortunate to have seen an increase in revenue, particularly from television broadcast, in recent years. This has put us in a position to explore even more ways to support the greater university mission." The UI's $50 million internal loan comes as its governing Board of Regents is asking lawmakers to restore $8 million the legislature cut from the board's appropriation mid-fiscal 2020 and increase the state's general education support another $18 million for fiscal 2022. The UI recently created another new revenue stream by entering into a public-private partnership for the operation of its utility system, enabling the creation of an endowment expected to generate $15 million annually to help the UI's strategic plan. But spokeswoman Bassett said that was not in play for the athletics department loan. Investment revenue generated from the public-private partnership, or P3, for the university's utility system is solely dedicated to supporting initiatives to bolster student success and develop and retain faculty, she said. The loan comes as Hawkeye Athletics has gained significant aid from donors as well. Last week, UI Athletics announced that two longtime donors, owners of the world's largest truck stop on Interstate 80, Will and Renee Moon, were contributing $10 million to the Hawkeye football program. Half the total will create an endowment for the head coaching position, which now will be referred to as the Moon Family Head Football Coach. Of the remaining $5 million, $3 million will establish a Will and Renee Moon Excellence Fund to support football and other athletics initiatives as determined by the athletics director. The last $2 million will support a Kinnick Edge campaign for the revitalization of the stadium's north end zone seating and concourse. Earlier in March, the UI announced that former Hawkeye basketball player Sue Beckworth gave $7 million in support of women's athletics. The gift will endow the position of basketball coach Lisa Bluder and all future head women's basketball coaches who will hold the title of P. Sue Beckworth, M.D. Part of the gift also will benefit the P. Sue Beckworth, M.D. Black and Gold Opportunities Fund, which provides support to all Hawkeye women's sports. Harold is retiring in 6 weeks, 2 years before the end of his extended contract. His departure means that $2.3 million in deferred compensation he was due had he remained a board employee through 2023 will be forfeited. Also on the front page, union Anamosa murders underscore shortages. Iowa's prisons are 10% over capacity, but 9% understaffed. This story by Aaron Jordan. The murders of two employees at the Anamosa State Penitentiary on March 23 are the climax of chronic staffing shortages at the state's prisons, according to labor union that represents prison workers. 10 nursing jobs, or 35% of the authorized nursing positions at the Anamosa prison, are vacant because of lack of state funding. AFSCME Council 61 reports there are 14 correctional officer vacancies, or about 6% of the authorized positions at the state prison, with 850 inmates, according to the union. Statewide, prison systems, which are 10% over capacity, are about 9% understaffed, the AFSCME said in a letter sent last week to Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and leaders of the Iowa House and Senate. For years, inadequate funding has seen the number of correctional officers and corrections staff drop. AFSCME Council 61 President Danny Homan wrote in the March 31 letter to Reynolds, Representatives Pat Grassley, Matt Winchetti, and Todd Pritchard, as well as Senators Zach Walls, Jack Whitmer, and Jake Chapman. What happened in Anamosa was a tragedy that never should have happened. You have the power now in these final weeks of the session to ensure it does not happen again. AFSCME, which has called a news conference for 11 a.m. today outside the Iowa Capitol in Des Moines, is asking the legislature to fully fund 234 vacant positions in the Department of Corrections, restore collective bargaining rights so employees can negotiate workplace safety, and conduct an independent investigation of the March 23 murders in Anamosa. Two inmates, Michael Dutcher and Thomas Woodard, face murder, kidnapping, and attempted murder charges based on allegations they struck Correctional Officer Robert McFarland and nurse Lorena Schulte in the head with hammers, killing them. The inmates took Lori Mathis, another Anamosa employee, hostage briefly and seriously wounded another inmate, McKinley Roby, investigators allege. Woodard and Dutcher are attempting to escape, or were attempting to escape the prison, and used the hammers to break the window in an employee break room off the infirmary, authorities said. They tried but failed to use a grinder from the prison maintenance department to cut through metal bars covering the windows. The inmates who were part of the maintenance crew gained access to the area under the pretense of fixing something. Iowa state institutions have become more dangerous for employees, the union said in a letter. Before the March 23 murders, the corrections department had reported a dozen assaults of staff by offenders in the previous year, the Gazette reported last month. AFSCME also highlighted the 2018 beating of a nurse at the Mental Health Institute in Independence. Tina Suckow was beaten until she was unconscious. Then later, as she was recovering from surgeries related to the attack, the state fired her, according to a 2019 Des Moines Register investigation. The union alleges changes to collective bargaining rights for public employee unions made in 2017 have eroded worker safety. The Gazette asked the Corrections Department to verify AFSCME staffing numbers at the Anamosa prison, but the agency did not immediately respond. Walls, a Coralville Democrat, said he supports AFSCME's proposed steps, including funding vacant prison vacancies. Walls, a Coralville Democrat, said he supports AFSCME's proposed steps, including funding vacant prison vacancies. The legislature last month approved $4 million more for correctional workers in fiscal 2022, but that will only help the agency provide 1.1% pay increases to current employees, not hire new officers, Walls said. In terms of likelihood of supplemental funding, that will depend on the Republicans, who control both the House and Senate, Walls said. He'd also like the legislature to require an independent investigation of the March 23 attack, rather than letting the Corrections Department do its own probe. That will create real accountability. Without an independent investigation, I doubt we'll really know what happened. Moving to the Iowa Today page, the Marion woman killed by a ditch fire has been identified, this by Lee Hermiston. The Linn County Sheriff's Office has identified the woman killed when a fire spread out of control Sunday afternoon. The Sheriff's Office said Carol J. Woodson, age 79, of Marion, was tending a ditch fire in the 3000 block of Gilmore Road when the fire grew out of control. Woodson was fatally injured by the fire and pronounced dead at the scene. The fatal fire remains under investigation by the Sheriff's Office and the State Fire Marshal's Office. According to the Iowa Department of Public Safety, no current bans on open burning had been reported to it on Sunday in either Linn or Johnson counties. Nonetheless, the National Weather Service cautioned that wind gusts Sunday and Monday made open burning risky. Any fire that develops could quickly get out of control. Outdoor burning is strongly discouraged, the Weather Service said. And a Cedar Rapids man faces charges after shots fired, this by Lee Hermiston. A Cedar Rapids man faces charges following a shot-fired incident Sunday evening. Cedar Rapids police were called to the 1600 block of 30th Street Northwest around 6:43 p.m. Witnesses reported a man shot a gun into the air and threatened to shoot another man before fleeing on foot. Responding officers identified Nicholas M. Johnson, age 27, as the suspect, according to the police department. Johnson was found in a vehicle in the 800 block of D Avenue Northwest at 7:57 p.m. Police found a 9mm handgun under the seat. An investigation determined Johnson fired six shots into the air outside an apartment complex after getting into an argument, police said. Johnson faces charges of reckless use of a firearm and possession of marijuana. Two men arrested after a fatal stabbing in Cedar Rapids. This story again by Lee Hermiston. Two men are in custody following a fatal stabbing of a 33-year-old man early Monday in Cedar Rapids. This in a Cedar Rapids hotel room. Cedar Rapids police arrested Victoriano Diaz Barrera, age 39, on charges of first-degree murder, going armed with intent, and assault with a dangerous weapon. Another man at the scene, 29-year-old Anthony Diaz, was wanted for murder in Texas. He also was arrested, the police department said. Police were called to the Residence Inn, 1900 Dodge Street Northeast, just after midnight on Sunday. Police and first responders found a man suffering from a stab wound to his upper torso. First responders tried to save him, but he was pronounced dead at the scene, according to the Cedar Rapids Police Department. His identity is being withheld at this time. Police said several people were in the room at the time of the stabbing. An argument between the victim and Diaz Barrera broke out before. Diaz Barrera and the victim knew each other, but police said they are not releasing additional details while the investigation continues. Diaz-Barrera, and Diaz are in custody at the Linn County Jail. First-degree murder is a Class A felony punishable by an automatic life sentence. Two killed in vehicle crashes in Iowa. Two people have died in as many days in traffic accidents on Iowa's roads. On Monday morning, 73-year-old Hazel Ann Griffiths of Brooklyn, Iowa, was killed in a Tama County crash, the Des Moines Register reported. Griffiths was driving west on County Road E66 at 6:50 a.m. when she failed to stop at a stop sign and entered eastbound traffic on U.S. Highway 30, where her vehicle collided with another, according to the Iowa State Patrol. She was pronounced dead at the scene. The other driver was transported to a hospital. On Sunday evening, a two-vehicle crash killed a Des Moines man, according to the Iowa State Patrol. That accident happened around 6 p.m. on Highway 17 and 158th Avenue south of Madrid, Iowa. Authorities said David Turner, age 65, was driving a 2005 Honda Civic when he failed to stop at a stop sign and his vehicle was struck by a 2013 Chrysler van. The driver of the van had minor injuries. And man enters plea in vehicle crash death. A northwestern Iowa man has pleaded not guilty to vehicular homicide in the death of a woman who was a passenger on the utility vehicle he was driving when it crashed. Christopher Bosma, age 48, of Lake Park, entered the written plea Friday, the Sioux City Journal reported. He is charged with vehicular homicide while driving intoxicated and vehicular homicide due to reckless driving in the July 18 death of Kelsey Strum, age 34, of Lake Park. Investigators have said Bosma was participating in a UTV poker run that involved bar hopping in several towns on the day of the crash, and that he told detectives he had consumed 8 or 9 drinks before the crash. Police said Bosma was eastbound on a trail west of Harris when he turned onto a Sibley street, accelerated quickly, and lost control. According to police, the vehicle swerved from side to side before its rear tires dropped off the road's edge and crashed. Strum was thrown from the vehicle, which tipped over on top of her. She was taken to a hospital where she later died. If convicted, Bosma faces up to 35 years in prison. Also on the Iowa Today page, the DNR okays an 11,600-head cattle feedlot. Environmentalists say it will endanger Iowa trout streams. This story by Aaron Jordan. The Iowa DNR has approved the nutrient management plan of an 11,600-head open cattle feedlot near Monona. Supreme Beef, owned by Mike Walls, Dean Walls, and Jared Walls, now may complete the project started in 2017, but stalled by environmental violations, opposition from neighbors, and legal wrangling with two former business partners. Environmental groups were not happy with the decision. If DNR can approve this facility, which is located in sensitive karst topography in the watershed of an outstanding Iowa water and important cold water trout streams, then current Iowa laws and regulations provide no protection of the public interest and exist solely to rubber stamp livestock industry interests. Ingrid Gronstahl, Water Program Director of the Iowa Environmental Council, said in a statement, Steve Vesey, a retired Iowa State University employee and Iowa water quality advocate, said in a March 2 public hearing, the computations used in the plan to show how much liquid manure from the facility can safely be applied were inadequate. Opponents also said the plan called for putting manure on fields 20 miles away, which they said wasn't realistic given the cost to transport the manure. The DNR did seek some changes to the nutrient management plan, the agency noted in an April 2 letter sent to the company and provided to the Gazette. One field listed as accepting manure from the feedlot was removed from the plan, and details for two other fields were revised appropriately, the DNR noted. Wally Taylor, conservation chair of the Sierra Club's Iowa chapter, said he felt the DNR relied on assumptions and incomplete information in the rush to approve the plan within the 60-day limit. Instead of rejecting the NMP, DNR is approving it, hoping everything will eventually work out, he said. Back in 2017, when the Walzes and other earlier partners proposed the project, they said they planned to invest $30 million in the site, which would include anaerobic digesters that would convert manure and food waste into natural gas. The new versions of the nutrient management plan do not call for digesters. The change in plans has meant an operation once considered an industrial facility because of a waste-to-energy strategy became a large open feedlot, which has a different set of rules. This has put the DNR in a position of jerry-rigging its review of the NMP, Taylor said. In 2018, the DNR fined the owners $10,000, the maximum the agency can impose, for stormwater runoff violations. In 2019, the Walzes sued their former business partners, John Hammond and Heath Kellogg, saying the men lied about having secured a loan of $15 million for the project. A judge ordered Hammond and Kellogg to pay the Walzes $308,309 and ordered their firm, Feeder Creek Group, dissociate with the Walzes. The group settled in December 2019, court records show. Supreme Beef submitted a nutrient management plan last summer for 11,600 head of cattle, but the DNR approved the plan for only 2,700 cows. Moving over to the Insight page, this is Adam Solomon's column titled, Libertarian Agenda is Out at Capitol. Last week was the second funnel deadline of the 2021 legislative session, part of an annual timetable meant to winnow out bills that aren't advancing. With a few exceptions, the legislature now only will consider bills that have earned approval from one chamber as well as a standing committee in the other. That means we can say good riddance to some of lawmakers' worst ideas this year, but also a reluctant farewell to some of their good ones. Republicans controlling the Iowa legislature have a fickle relationship with personal freedom. They're libertarians one day and nanny statists the next. They're letting several pro-freedom bills fall by the wayside. Marijuana, a bill to reduce penalties for first-time possession of small amounts of marijuana, would save the correctional system $1 million annually and reduce disproportionate minority contact with police, according to legislative analysts. A majority of Iowans fully support legal marijuana, but Iowa maintains one of the nation's harshest drug prohibition laws. Felon voting. Iowa is one of a few states without a law to automatically restore felons' voting rights after they completed their sentences. Governor Kim Reynolds signed an executive order to that effect last year, but without a law or constitutional amendment, it could easily be revoked by a future governor. Lawmakers this year have failed to pass two measures that would restore felon voting rights. Birth control. Hormonal contraceptives are relatively safe, but still subject to unnecessary regulations, including a requirement for a prescription from a doctor, which makes family planning more expensive and less accessible for Iowa women. A bill to allow for over-the-counter birth control, backed by the governor, but opposed by influential social conservative groups, sits idle in the legislature. Gambling. Iowa's dusty old gambling restrictions got a fresh coat of paint when the legislature legalized sports betting in 2019, but the state likely won't expand on that success this year. Lawmakers are set to cast aside bills to legalize betting on esports and deregulate card tournaments hosted by veterans organizations. Surveillance. Automated traffic enforcement has become a perennial issue in the state legislature. Lawmakers repeatedly bring it up and repeatedly fail to enact meaningful measures to protect the public from privacy and due process violations. A bill to ban most traffic enforcement cams has been left stranded in Des Moines. These proposals, theoretically, could be resurrected by legislative leaders or tacked on to other items as the session nears adjournment. But for now, they are among more than three dozen bills killed by the funnel, according to a list compiled by the Gazette's Rod Boschart. Some good bills remain eligible for debate, along with a long list of bad ones. The Iowa legislature's outstanding anti-freedom agenda includes measures to limit abortion rights, eliminate consumer choice at fuel pumps, slap exorbitant taxes on tobacco pipes, and beef up or create new criminal penalties. The majority party purports to favor freedom and limited government. Just make sure you don't smoke a joint, buy birth control online, or play too many poker games at your local American Legion. And again, that is Adam Sullivan. One community letter today. NCAA still has miles to go toward equality. It is interesting to read about the gaffe by the NCAA regarding the women's basketball tournament's facilities and fitness equipment. Disparity continues to exist. To give some history, in the late 1960s, the opportunity for women in sports at the University of Iowa was slowly moving from an intramural participation level to an extramural program, and then to an interscholastic program in 1967. By 1969, the UI fielded a women's basketball team that played 9 games against teams such as Luther, Iowa Wesleyan, Wheaton College in Illinois, and others. As a member of this team, I traveled by UI van to games paid for from the Physical Education Department funds. Team members paid for their own meals, washed their own uniforms, and only stayed overnight for one game at Wheaton College in campus dorm rooms. That winter, the UI women's team was invited to the first national tournament in Westchester, Pennsylvania. The men's team that year did not get a bid to the NCAA, so our team was able to borrow the men's warm-up jackets. Our point guard was 5'2" tall. Her jacket came down below her knees. However ill-fitting they were, we were thrilled to wear the jackets because they identified who we were, the Iowa Hawkeyes. Equality for women in sports has come a long way in 52 years. With the recent gaffe by the NCAA, there appears to be miles to go. And that letter signed by Jean Hamill from Marion. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, April 6th on IRIS. And now we turn to today's obituaries. In the other notices from Iowa City, Joanne Hannaford, age 92, died Friday, April 2, Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. Also in Iowa City, Dean Rammelsberg, age 97, died Friday, April 2, Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. From Luxembourg, Merlin J. Leek, age 89, died Thursday, April 1. Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. In Maquoketa, Elaine A. Dull, age 64, died Saturday, April 3. Dawson Funeral Home, Maquoketa. In Marion, Joy A. Luco, age 84, died Sunday, April 4. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. Also in Marion, Carol Woodson, age 79, died Sunday, April 4. The Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center, Cedar Rapids. In Postville, Terry Lee Mose, age 63, died Friday, April 2. Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Monona. In Ridgeway, Eric Rodas, age 44, died Friday, April 2. Schluter Ballack Funeral Home, Decorah. And from Vinton, Larry Pickering, age 80, died Monday, April 5. Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton. Moving now to the regular notices from Monticello, Raymond Leroy Kleinow, age 90, died Thursday, April 1 at the Monticello Nursing and Rehab Center following a brief illness. Services will be held at a later date to be announced. From Cedar Rapids, Shirley M. Barta passed away April 2 from age-related complications after a stroke at Helmar Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. She would have been 92 years young on her approaching May birthday. A private funeral service will be held for Shirley Barta. From Cedar Bluff, Barry Glick, age 73, of Cedar Bluff, was called home to the Gardens of Heaven Saturday, April 3, from complications after heart surgery. A celebration of life officiated by Pastor Jay Amundson will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, April 7, at the United Methodist Church in Tipton. Also at the Methodist Church, family will have a time of visitation from 9 to 10:30 a.m. and will continue to receive friends in the church's fellowship room from 11:30 to 1. Family and church staff ask all visitors to enter the church from the Lynn Street entrance. Memorials for the Tipton United Methodist Church and the Tipton Fine Arts Council have been created in Barry's memory. The Fry Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Iowa City, James Allen Lee, formerly of Troy Mills, died April 4, Easter Sunday, after a short illness. In accordance with Jim's wishes, there will be no visitation. Private family services will be held with burial at Mount Clark Cemetery in Central City. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the Troy Mills Historical Society. The Murdoch Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Cedar Rapids, Lisa Mae Pisney, age 52, died Sunday, April 4, at her home. Funeral service is at 2 p.m. Wednesday, April 7, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. Visitation will begin 1 hour prior to the service. Burial at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Also in Cedar Rapids, Jerry Ann Plotz, age 84, passed away Sunday, April 4, at the Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. A public visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, April 7, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. In Cedar Rapids, Ramon Vassar, born June 25, 1984, Ramon passed away on March 19. Services will be held at 1 p.m. Thursday, April 8, at Lifeline Ministries Church in Cedar Rapids. From Cloutier, Blake Laura Pearson, age 47, died April 2 at his home. Visitation will be from 9 to 11, Friday, April 9, at Overton Funeral Home in Traer, followed by a graveside service at Oneida Cemetery north of Cloutier. The Overton Funeral Home in Traer is assisting the family. From Alburnett, John Marion Harford. Per John's wishes, there will be no funeral. His family will hold a private celebration of life at a later time. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established in his name. In Cedar Rapids, John Powers, age 73, passed away Easter morning, April 4, after a long battle with the effects of Agent Orange. A visitation will be held from 1 to 3, Thursday, April 8, at the Sharon United Methodist Church, 1809 9th Street, Southwest in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will follow at 3 p.m. Thursday at the church. From Ely, Kelly L. Nelson, age 60, died at his home Saturday, April 3. A celebration of life service will be held later this summer. Iowa Cremation is in charge of arrangements. In Center Point, Jeffrey Glenn Brown, age 47, of Center Point, passed away March 29. A public gathering will be from 4 to 7, Wednesday, April 7, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories Stateroom. A public funeral service will take place at 1 p.m. Thursday, April 8, at New Covenant Bible Church. Private burial will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery with military rites. From Coralville, Vicki Lynn Hostoski, age 73, passed away April 1 at her home following a long illness. Honoring her wishes, cremation rites have been accorded. Private family service will be held. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be directed to Iowa City Hospice. From Monona, Colleen A. Darby passed away March 24 at the Carroll Center Nursing Home in Sarasota, Florida, after a short illness. In lieu of flowers, Colleen requested that donations be made to the Monona Ambulance Fund or the Glen Ridge Players. At a later date, there will be a celebration of life at Glen Ridge in Sarasota, Florida, and a memorial service at St. Paul's Lutheran in Monona. From Iowa City, Walter C. Linnell, or Linnell, age 57, died at his home Saturday, April 3. The time of visitation will be held for family and friends from 4 to 7, Wednesday, April 7, at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service. From Iowa City, Elva L., known as Babe Phillips, age 99, passed away Friday, April 2, at the Solon Nursing and Rehab Center. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 Monday, April 12, at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church in Iowa City. A Mass of Christian burial will begin at 11 a.m. Following the Mass, Babe will be laid to rest next to her husband at St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City. Instead of flowers and plants, please consider memorial donations to the Solon Retirement Village. Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City is handling arrangements. From West Union, Ruth Bisson Mosier, age 93, passed away Easter Sunday at her home at Stony Brook Assisted Living in West Union. There will be a celebration of Ruth's life at a later date. From Keystone, Stephen G., known as Steve Radicke, age 68, passed away Sunday, April 4, at his home in Keystone. Memorial services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, April 8, at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Van Horn, with the Reverend G. Andrew Wright officiating. Interment will be held at Keystone Cemetery with graveside military rites. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 Wednesday at Phillips Funeral Home in Keystone. From Monticello, Joseph Spar died Thursday, February 11. Joseph was 80 years old. He died at the Jones Regional Medical Center following a sudden illness. Funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 10, at Peace United Church of Christ in Monticello, with interment in Oakland Cemetery. Friends may call from 4 to 7 Friday, April 9, at Getch Funeral Home in Monticello. You may access the live service by going online at thegetchonline.com and then by clicking the Watch Our Live Services on the Facebook button. And lastly, from Williamsburg, Jeffrey Allen Albaugh, born December 6, 1958 in Cedar Rapids, passed away Saturday, April 3, at his home at the age of 62. Celebration of Life services will be at 6 p.m. Friday, April 6, at the Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. until service time Friday. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations be made to the Tater Tough Fund or CAST for Kids Foundation. Moving now to the sports page, one high school story, high school volleyball. Alyssa Thomas is back in town, will coach at Linmar. This story is by Jeff Linder. You could say that Alyssa Thomas is part of the Teresa Bear coaching tree once removed. It's kind of full circle, isn't it? Thomas said Monday after she was hired as the next volleyball coach at Linmar High School. Thomas, 23, is a 2016 Marion High School graduate, then played at Minnesota Crookston, from which she graduated in 2020. She coached 4 years at club volleyball while at Crookston. I'm definitely going to push the players to be the best they can be, but I'm going to do it in a positive manner, she said. At Marion, Thomas played for Roxanne Paulson, who played for Bear at Tripoli, in the 1980s. Bear coached at Linmar from 2013 through 2019 after a long, successful ride at Tripoli. She was succeeded by Morgan Mamoser, who guided the Lions to a 13-15 record in 2020. Since moving home, Thomas has served as a billing specialist for Covenant Family Solutions in Marion. Alyssa's knowledge of the game and experience and success as a high school and college player will help her be successful, Linmar Associate Athletics Director Tanya Moe said. She has the passion and energy that it will take to lead a 5A program. She is excited to be back in the community she grew up in and wants to give back to the sport that gave her so much. We're excited to have her here at Linmar. Top returning players for the Lions in 2021 include seniors-to-be Monet Young and Lauren Werner. And events of area interest in boys track, Prairie, Iowa City West at North Scott Invitational at 4 p.m. City High is at the High Covey Relays in Ames at 4. Jefferson, Kennedy, Linmar, Xavier are at Western Dubuque Invitational at 4:15. And Regina is at the Williamsburg Invitational also at 4:15. Marion is at Anamosa at 4:30. And in girls track, City High is at Ames Invitational at 4 p.m. Xavier, Jefferson, Kennedy, Linmar, and Prairie are at the Washington Invitational at Kingston Stadium at 4:30. Regina is at the Williamsburg Invitational also at 4:30. In girls soccer, Solon is at Marion, Linmar is at Cedar Falls, Ankeny is Iowa City West, and Mid Prairie is at Liberty. In boys soccer, Cedar Falls plays at Jefferson, Waterloo East is at Liberty, Kennedy at Dubuque-Wallert. Western Dubuque is at Xavier, Marion plays at Solon. City High is at Waterloo West, and Iowa City West plays at Prairie. Girls golf, Xavier tees off at Lisbon at 4 p.m. Boys tennis and girls tennis are also listed. For the boys, Cedar Falls is at Iowa City West, Washington at Dubuque Hempstead, Jefferson at Western Dubuque, City High at Dubuque Senior, and Liberty at Dubuque Wallert. Girls tennis starts off at 4 p.m. with Western Dubuque at Jefferson, Waterloo East at Kennedy, Dubuque Hempstead at Washington, Dubuque Senior is at City High, Dubuque Wallert is at Iowa City, Dubuque Wallert plays at Liberty, and Iowa City West is at Cedar Falls. Moving now to the community page, here are some Eastern Iowa briefs for today from Hiawatha. Hiawatha Library hosts plant and seed swap on Saturday. The Hiawatha Public Library at 150 West Wilman Street will play host to an outdoor plant and seed swap Saturday from 10 to 2. Bring your own seeds and plants to share with other community gardeners and leave with some new seeds to grow or a new plant friend. In case of inclement weather, plants will be moved inside the lobby. In Cedar Rapids, Thursday's virtual talk, Disease Themes in Opera. How does opera portray diseases like tuberculosis and cholera while exploring the social, moral, and aesthetic issues of a period in history? That's the topic of Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's second Thursday free online program, debuting at 7 p.m. Thursday on youtube.com/Cedar Rapids Opera, and after that at CROpera.org. The discussion features two veteran University of Iowa faculty members, Karen Walkschmuth and Christopher Squire, who have co-taught a first-year seminar for the past 5 years on music and disease. Walkschmuth is Associate Director of International Fellowships and Fulbright Program Advisor in International Programs. She holds a Doctor of Musical Arts degree in choral conducting from the University of Colorado Boulder and a master's from the Juilliard School, and has worked as a professional musician and music professor. She also has served the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater as chorus master, writer, and lecturer. Squire is Emeritus Professor of Oral Pathology in the UI College of Dentistry and Emeritus Director of the UI's Global Health Studies Program. He has served on the State Commission for Tobacco Control and on the board of the Midwest Division of the American Cancer Society, which bestowed the St. George Medal in 2007 for his contributions. Recognized internationally for his work on oral cancer, Squire has published more than 200 books. For more information, go to CROpera.org/famous-last-gasps. And from North Liberty, sign up for North Liberty Lions tree distribution on Friday. The North Liberty Lions Club has received 200 seedlings from the State Forest Nursery through a grant from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Seedlings are now available for pre-reservation via Eventbrite at, there's an online reference here, and it will be available for pickup from 5 to 8 Friday at First United Methodist Church, 85 North Jones Boulevard, North Liberty. Any trees not claimed by 7 p.m. that day will become available to the public on a first-come, first-served basis until 8 p.m. or while the supplies last. The Iowa native seedlings will be about 25 inches tall and come in a variety of white oak, red oak, and sugar maple. Select your tree variety upon pickup at the event Friday. Each tree will come with basic planting and care instructions from the State Forest Nursery. Community members do not have to have lost trees during the derecho to receive a tree from this event. This project follows an earlier effort in the fall of 2020 where the North Liberty Lions received an LCIF disaster grant, which allowed the club to provide area families with funds to replace perishable food items lost during power outages due to the derecho. And on the community page, Piecing Together History. Designs Heritage to Modern, coming to Quilt a Manna Show and Sale. This story by Diana Nolan. Tradition binds the old and new worlds of historic Amana colonies, and this weekend the fabric of both realms will be on display at the inaugural Quilt Amana. Originally planned to debut last year but sidelined by the pandemic, this quilt show and sale, sponsored by Heritage Designs Quilting and Needlework, will be filling the nearby Price Creek Event Center with a full spectrum of colors, designs, and price tags. A weekend pass is just $5, but if you're looking to buy, more than 150 quilts will be offered for sale, from table runners and toppers that start at $15 to $30 to over $1,000 quilts. Even more will be on display, including antique quilts, traditional Amana whole cloth quilts, baby quilts, wall hangings, and modern optical illusion and whimsical designs. One-of-a-kind art quilts will also be available, including works by fiber artist and award-winning quilter Sue Kluber of Guernsey, who specializes in nature-inspired art pieces. "This is literally something for everyone," said Danita Simmons, 36, of Amana, manager of the Heritage Design Store, located by the Festhall Barn and Price Creek Event Center. "We have utilitarian quilts that you can buy for a reasonable price and take home and throw on your couch and cuddle and love. And they're very durable, fun pieces, up to our quilts that you would display on your wall. We will have a few quilts of valor because that's something I'm very passionate about," added Jane Bazin, age 67, of Victor. She said she has the best of both worlds, because while she isn't a Heritage Design employee, she works for the store making quilts. "I get all gamuts. I can make a reproduction quilt 1 week, and the next week I'll be given batiks." She began in 2018 creating quilts to wrap around World War II and Korean War veterans, and the following year, Vietnam veterans were added. In the first 2 years, 65 were available and 55 were accepted. When the pandemic subsides, another 35 are ready to be distributed to veterans of more recent conflicts as well. "The recipients always are surprised," Bazin said, "but some have declined because they felt they didn't deserve the recognition. She doesn't see it that way. She is adamant that all veterans, male and female, need to be honored." At a glance, this is Quilt Amana, taking place at the Price Creek Event Center, 4709 220th Trail in Amana. It will take place at 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. $5 weekend pass or free for ages 18 and under. Guests are asked to follow social distancing and mask recommendations. It will feature quilt displays, quilts for sale, swatch sales, art quilts, Amana quilts, and concessions are available on site. For more information regarding this event, you can go to heritagedesignsquiltshop.com/quiltamana-2021. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day.
This is Jim Ralston with an Irish short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers from Dubuque. Don Dwyer, creator and curator of the World of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. "I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers," he told me. "I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library." While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers strategy, just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play, from famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checker strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Dwyer, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. "Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training," Don said. He unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. "It's like the Mona Lisa," Mr. Checker said, of his museum. "You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dwyer." If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.